Welcome to Beyond Bitcoin, a podcast about all things digital assets, the global communities they are creating, the generations that are using and investing in them, and the challenges faced by the nations that are seeking to regulate them. The content of this program is not to be taken as investment advice. The opinions expressed in the program by the host and the guests are their personal opinions only. Remember, feel free to subscribe and share with like-minded friends. My name is Derek Graham. I'm the CEO of Portal Asset Management, and my co-host is Nitin Gower, Managing Director of State Street Digital Assets.
Good morning, and welcome along to another episode of Beyond Bitcoin. Beyond Bitcoin tends to cover deep dive technologies. We comment on marketplaces. We comment on our travels. I'm currently in Singapore in a lovely row hotel in Chinatown. I love Chinatown, love Singapore. We currently, you know, we talk about the markets and where that's up to. And of course, the CCI 30 at the moment, which is the cryptocurrency top 30 tokens, is sitting at about 17,000. That's about halfway to the all-time high. But what has hit an all-time high is Bitcoin, with some $70,000 as of today. Ethereum is sitting north of 4,000. The market's bubbling ahead, all very good. And I must remind everyone, please subscribe to our travels, to our discussions, to our now regular guests that come in here and discuss their protocols, the market trading, etc. And today, of course, with my partner and co-host as always, we're going to take a more philosophical journey to where we normally are, discussing the hard numbers of where Bitcoin's all-time high might be and the index, to something that I think is very profound. I love the story. Keen to hear more about it. Good morning to you, Nitin, and welcome along.
Hey, Derek. Good morning. And I see you have stopped your preamble of good morning, good afternoon, good evening. You are a true degen now, when it's always good morning in the crypto land. So welcome to the degen world. I'm glad to be here, Derek, and hope you had a safe and uneventful travel like I did a few weeks back. And as you know, I just came back from Bhutan and East Timor. So let's discuss a few more things around my observations, and we can share with notes from your trips as well.
Bhutan, I'm keen to hear.
Bhutan,
how is so the happiest amazing country nation in the world is coping with crypto?
Yeah, no, the intention again. It's an amazing country, which is so simple in its approach. It is simply brilliant, amazing landscape, as you know, Derek, and amazing and tolerant people, and just a massive, respect and empathy all around when you go there. And actually, I did take the poll for a lot of people I've met, hiked with, and met a lot of porters, guides, and restaurant owners, and actually asked the question, are you really happy, or are we being sold a whole different narrative outside of Bhutan? And there's a little bit of genuine take to it. And my objective there, Derek, to be honest with you, was just to take a break. As you know, I exited the corporate world, left my role, and working on a few things, and just wanted to hike and, take in fresh air and fresh perspectives, and hit a reset button to be able to think. And that lasted for a day, because I met some young guy who was the son of the hotel owner in capital of Bhutan, Thimphu. And the young Bhutanese recognized me and said, hey, aren't you that blockchain guy? I'm like, really? Like, out of all places in this small country. And he wanted to discuss crypto and his ambitions. And I learned actually a lot from him. I had breakfast with him. And his name is Tenzing, and I remember his name because it reminds me of Tenzing, who was the first sort of climber, Sherpa. And so I had an amazing conversation with him. I'm like, why do you want to get into this? Like, he's young, he understands this, he reads, he feels as if he's missing out. Nothing to do with unhappiness or happiness. He just wants to know what it is. And he had relatives in Singapore, and he would send them money the normal way, and he would actually ask them to procure Bitcoin on his behalf on their wallet. So talk about all kinds of counterparty risks and transaction costs, and simply sense of ownership, even though he didn't really own it, somebody else in Singapore owned on his behalf.
Yes.
And his ambition was to open a crypto exchange to address the needs of the youth like him in the country. Mm-hmm. And the 45 minutes of breakfast, and I could have speak to him for hours, but except that I had to go, my tour guide was like, hey, we need to go, we need to start our hike. And so he, we had an amazing conversation, and he wanted to open an exchange. So he connected with me on LinkedIn and said, can you help me with this? So in my past life, I was working with Bhutanese government because their ambition to roll up CBDC. He was aware of that. So all around, learned a lot. And I actually asked my guide, who was about the same age as the young kid. He was about 20, 22, 24. He knew about Bitcoin. He wanted to know more about it. When I told him I'm in that space. And that was the end of my piece, because all in the car, when we were going from one mountain to the mountain, it was all about, you know, how do I get into this? What are the upside, the risk with it? And so I chose to hike alone. I'm like, you need to just leave me alone, because the whole idea was to to think through. So it was all great. And I came back and immediately went to eat Denver.
See, that's sublime the ridiculous, isn't it? To go from Bhutan to East Denver, ETH contest, ETH Denver. And that is just, look, firstly, the reflection of that is extraordinary. I mean, here is a nation that I think is aspirational in so many ways. It certainly is for me. You know, a nation that looks for the National Happiness Index and doesn't just judge itself on gross domestic product. A nation where people are truly respected of each other, respectful of each other, and visitors like yourself are welcome. In that environment, they're quietly saying, tell me about Bitcoin. Tell me about this space. How can we be involved with it? How can the youth, as you say, be involved with it? I think that is, yeah, that's quite beautiful. And it's brilliant of you to have actually put a line in the sand between your corporate world and the world that you're now in, which of course includes Portal Asset Management, which we're delighted to have you involved with. And you know, I think many people would have loved to have had that experience. So while you're away, of course, the industry is booming ahead for that week or so. You missed a lot, but nothing, because there's so much happening all the time in this industry. And there's been a lot of discussion around EIP 484, and a lot of discussion around, you know, the ETH ETF that is not a certainty, but is a likelihood coming. What was the buzz like at ETH Denver?
Yeah, actually, it was super interesting, Derek, because, you know, ETH Denver was, again, it's amazing and so much energy. It was exhausting. It really was exhausting to spend the time. And I was there for like almost 4 days, Derek, and we might as well call it ETH or Denver BTC, because there were so many events before the official start of ETH Denver. There were so many Bitcoin events. I was told by my cohorts and colleagues and investors, the fellow investors who I met, and like, you know, you missed all these events. I'm like, I don't really miss anything, because you can always catch up. I've never felt the FOMO, because we are so ingrained, especially now with full-time focusing on Portal and growing Portal in, you know, in the various parts of the world. We are tuned in, we're plugged in. So I'm not missing the narrative. I'm simply missing some of the conversations that could be enriching at some, you know, some point. But there were too many events, and I looked at the roster. There were close to about 1,000 events happening that week in Bitcoin. I had the whole, somebody sent me a Google Docs, and I was shocked. I'm like, how do you keep track of this thing? It's completely crazy to do that. But we had an agenda, right? My agenda was focused on a few things. I'm focused on usability, which means that I do aspire to see the industry go beyond the 100 million of crypto, you know, degens and native users to more ubiquitous utility of Bitcoin across the world. So what you see, as you mentioned, with EIP 4844, which is going towards scalability and further reducing the global cost of transaction processing, which is what on Ethereum alone. But the work that has happened in the last, I would say, 5+ years with this layer 2 protocol, zero knowledge proofs, which is privacy preservation and scalability, all that is actually now relevant in Bitcoin context, because a lot of conversation, which I think I missed out on that piece of conversation, was around building, taking the EVM, which is so systemic to Bitcoin, Derek, or Ethereum ecosystem for portability of applications, that if that word, that construct were to manifest itself in Bitcoin ecosystems, suddenly you have this massive growth of applications in the structural and the benchmark asset of the industry itself. So a lot of conversation in BitVM, which is equivalent to an EVM on Ethereum virtual machine, which allows for portability and hence applications that you can write once and run anywhere on any of the ecosystems and take advantage of the underlying liquidity that they provide. So a lot of focus was on the EIP 4844, which is the Denkun sort of release, which is due this month. especially after the testnets were announced, a lot of focus on usability. And I'll explain on in terms of Web3 auth and bringing new sort of, you know, taking advantage of account abstraction and building intent protocols, which really takes a whole new step in not having to deal with the entire narrative of what happens if you lose your keys and solving that problem, that it shouldn't be clunky. It should be very user-friendly. And there's been a lot of work that Coinbase has done on the Base network. So happy to share some of that perspective. So to me, usability, scalability, and building, leveraging these two constructs and building newer financial products, which is cross-chain and removing the complexity of dealing with cross-chain mobility of assets. All around, these were some of the thematic thing that I took away with me. And of course, I met a bunch of investors and wanted to get their investor because I do keep track of where the money's heading and what do the investors think. So again, very, very energetic. I met a lot of people who are working on some really, really cool projects. And, you know, I represent, of course, talked about what Portal is focused on, both as an investor, but also the fact that we are entrenched in not just investing in liquid tokens, but also invest in understanding where the industry is heading. So we can support the industry, bringing our investors to that landscape and helping them understand the innovation and innovation-led growth that this industry has to bring. So super, super pumped after I came back. And it's just been a week, but I still feel that it's been yesterday.
Mm. That's the wonder of attending a great conference. It's scintillating. And so the other thing, of course, that's happening with ETH at the moment, the Deacon, you know, upgrade, is that it's going to rapidly improve the speed of layer two protocols and therefore the transactional speed of Ethereum. And it should reduce the cost too associated with the transactional speed of Ethereum, which is, you know, obviously the critic's biggest issue. But the Ethereum network is enormous. We must remind people that the Ethereum network is a little bit like Singapore that I'm currently in. In other words, it's an enormous infrastructure of which the entire city and all of its businesses are built upon. And it's not just a payment gateway or a payment process. And so it's extraordinarily complex to create this enormous city of which the vast majority of all DeFi protocols are still built upon. And so it's very important where Ethereum is heading. It's very important that they're reducing costs. And it's very important that they're making usability that much better, that much easier. You know, we often speak about normies, meaning normal people being able to use wallets without concern about losing their keys. It's terribly important because if you have a reasonable amount of wealth, your perception of reasonable amount of wealth sitting in a wallet, you're going to be very concerned about where the keys are, who has access to them, et cetera. So there's a lot of usability improvement that can come this way to make this industry go from its few hundred million users to its billion users to its 2 and 3 billion users. So from that, you also got a sense of some extraordinary projects getting built on it. And I know this because you and I and the investment committee at Radiance have been discussing some of these earlier stage protocols that we find really fascinating. Do you want to pull one of those out and have a discussion around
that? Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So for example, you know, the EIP-4844 in the Denken release, and Denken as in it's a portmanteau of the, you know, Deneb and Cancun. As you know, the projects have always named after either a city and the testnets after one of the, you know, the subway stations around the world. So it's always
the railway stations,
to see the railway stations, right? So the idea behind that was that they wanted to make Ethereum much more economical, because right now Ethereum at 4,000 something today is quite an expensive network to transact on. So the idea is if you make it cheaper. But my question was that we have layer twos. So the likes of Polygon, Arbitrum, and Optimism, these are all the various layer two, you know, protocols that are meant to reduce the cost of transactions. So what is the impact if the idea behind this proto-dank sharding, which essentially is creating this, it, you know, this particular improvement introduces a blob carrying transaction, which is increase the amount of data that goes into this and not keep the data all the time in these blocks for purposes of efficiency and remove the blocks after you're done processing them and keep just the transactional reference and metadata into the immutable elements, which makes blockchain what it is. So it's certainly innovative. And that distribution leads to reduction of cost. But my question was, So what do L2s do then if things become super cheaper? Well, the idea is L2 should be next to nothing. It should be free. And then my question was, well, what's the incentive economics here? Because suddenly now, if everything becomes next to nothing, then how do you incentivize the validators and the decentralization of these networks that keep up the validation and verification of these transactions that eventually go into? So a lot of conversation on zero knowledge proofs, which increases scalability, a lot of conversation in terms of some of the newer technologies that have popped up. So for example, there is a protocol called Union Protocol that I came across, spent some time with them, which is looking into sovereign interoperability between various layers twos, because the idea of every layer two was its own blockchain. So there was hardly any communication between layer twos. So if you have to communicate between the two layer twos, you have to go all the way to layer one and come back to layer two. And that is one mechanism for us to either transact and move assets, which was expensive because at the end of the day, you are touching the layer one, which is, you know, expensive to begin with. And then I encountered something called Layer Zero Labs, which is focused on colored tokens, you know, and an omni-chain future, working with Verify USD Foundation to say, hey, I can take these tokens and I can define these tokens such a way that no matter which ecosystem these tokens go, I'm able to have the same yield. If the token belongs to Derek and Derek actually has hypothecated these tokens, it's always Derek who's going to get the yield no matter where the token ends up going and whichever ecosystem they end up going. Again, that's an innovation that focuses on usability. So you're not tied to keeping track of the yield on specific chains. You eventually have those yield come to you as long as you're, again, confined to the ecosystem. And then we look into things like WebAuth, Web3 Auth, which is purely focused on usability. Protocols such as intent protocols, and I'm actually neck deep in intent protocols, which basically, I wrote an article on this last week. So for the audiences, you should spend some time in that. This is the Bitcoin had the narrative of being your own bank. This is immediately after, as you know, 2008 financial crisis. And intent protocol aims to solve the usability problem by being your own fund manager, which says that not only you want to be your own bank, but you want to be able to leverage the high yields and reduce the complexity of DeFi ecosystem. And without actually understanding the complexities of, let's say, automated market makers, or liquidity pools, or decentralized exchanges, you simply want to provide a narrative or a descriptive to say, I want to have so much yield and this is my risk threshold, and let the intent protocols take that, resolve it into the meaningful transactions and deploy your capital in either high yield for low risk or going into higher risk but higher returns in other asset classes and deploy these funds into those areas. So you had, again, Project Light Across, which is a interoperability powered intent protocols, which allows you to leverage the various decentralized exchanges and automated market makers and high yield products across various ecosystems. And all you had to do is use account abstraction to describe your intentions and drive that forward. I spoke to Oasis Network. Again, you know, it's trying to solve the account impersonation issues where you're focusing on usability of EIP-712 and authentication, which is trusting the message sender and creating confidential contracts. Companies like Dynamic, which is focusing on usability to say, we are used to now using passphrases on Apple and using the same technologies that Apple obfuscates your ability to enter the password every single time using passphrases. Can we not bridge the gap between those biometrics and our familiarity with those protocols and connect them with the overall key management and account abstraction of what Ethereum has done? And I think some of these meaningful updates, Derek, and I'll pause in a minute and get your reaction to this, is that they eventually will go towards a better usable system and allowing for newer class wallets to show up, which allows for the normies or the non-degens, if I can use that term, to engage with the ecosystem and start leveraging it, which means suddenly now we increase in utility 10 folds or 100 folds only because now people understand it. So I'll pause, Derek. That has been just exhilarating time. And that's why I had to process all these things on the flight. I was completely exhausted because there's so much going on in the industry. And you feel like you're still a novice, even though we all have been, me and you have been this space for 12 plus years, right? So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Look, just to give some simple context to this for people who aren't as technical or deep into the details as you are, Nitin, let's talk a little bit about this. And in the simplest form, we often refer to this space currently with four layers. And that is layer zero being the layer that sits before often the actual mining protocols and the mining equipment that's running the layer one protocols. The layer one protocols being the infrastructure such as Ethereum, Polkadot, Solana, Cardano, so many others is a layer one protocol. So that's sitting there doing the many transactions, etc. Layer two protocols that are sitting on the side now we're talking about, and they're rolling up and doing high-speed transactions, and then they're placing across onto layer one so that they're reducing costs and increasing speed and efficiency on that. We often define as layer three being the decentralized finance realm, what I call the banking of ultimately the layer four protocols, which is Web 3.0. Web 3.0 being the web, which is read, write, and earn. And so I wanted to put that in context because what we're talking about there is a side activity here of these layer two protocols. And we're talking about, you know, talking about improving interoperability between layer two protocols, not just between layer two and layer one, which is, of course, the main blockchains. Yeah. And although that might sound like we're down in the weeds, what it shows you is that this industry is building out its entire infrastructure. Every aspect of it is getting created on a daily basis in this enormous amount of human power that is going towards thinking about how to build it. It is if we are doing even more so than the original creation of the internet, because the layers that we're talking about here are in many cases more complex than the original creation of the internet. And so when people say, you know, give me the killer application, the killer applications are already here, are coming, manifold, that'll be in the layer four protocols that are going to come. But you've got to build an entire commercial background, infrastructure, backbone, system, currencies, everything to enable those killer applications. And so I just wanted to put that into context so that people realize that we're talking about, you know, great opportunities between interoperability between layer two protocols. It might sound esoteric to you, but each one of these little pieces is another step towards, you know, the non-degens being able to use this without any knowledge of how this four layers of major protocols are operating.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know what, Derek, it's funny because we haven't even discussed a few more wrenches that have been thrown in the last ETH tenure. There's a company called EigenLayer, which has something called liquid restaking tokens, or LRTs for short. So there is Ethereum, which has, as we know, we discussed it here in detail on this podcast. We talked about essentially the merge where you move from proof of work to proof of stake, and you had to stake 32 ETHs at a time. It's expensive, very capital intensive initiatives. And you stake the tokens, and then you had to lock your tokens for a certain period of time. So they came up with this whole notion of something called liquid staking tokens, which basically says you have a token that you've staked, which is being productive in securing the network. And we're going to give you a representation of that staked token that you can use in liquid form. It's like you having money in a bank and using the bank as a collateral to borrow against that asset. This year or late last year, they begin to talk about, which is again, some of the ex-Polygon folks came up with something called liquid LRTs, restake tokens. And I find that funny because now you're taking the restake tokens, creating another layer on top. And there's a whole new vernacular that's around the LRTs and AVSs, which stands for actively validated services, which is an application layer protocol. And it was making my head spin to not only understand the technical imperatives of using that token as a restaking element, but also taking the restake tokens to provide security without actually having the burden of the underlying infrastructure that the Lido networks and Coinbase have done in terms of restaking and giving you a token that represents that element. And AVS has become an application level element. I've met a few projects who already are working on it. I'm like, this thing came about like 2 months back and suddenly people are creating economic models. So the pace at which the innovation has gone, now I don't know how successful this is going to be. I actually have a lot of technical and non-technical questions and economic questions of risk and, you know, creating this sort of massive scaffolding and in layers and layers, which actually have inherent risk to the underlying system, that what happens if the price of Ether drastically goes down, that happens in this industry, happens in every industry, does that sort of break the entire collateralization model? Because that's essentially what they're doing, which happens all the time in traditional finance. And that has nothing to do with technology. It actually, at that point, it becomes an economic sort of movement that takes shape and changes a lot of dynamics in terms of what happens when people collateralize the asset and build businesses on top of the collateral. Super interesting, confusing. And I'm like, you know, I think we're moving so fast without actually focusing on, in some cases, simplicity, that let's just get this right in terms of usability and getting more people before creating more and more layers, which to me was just mind-boggling, Derek. Just hard to keep up.
Yeah.
Truly hard to keep up.
Yes. So for those that are listening, I must say that are indulging in this extraordinary technology and taking on another level of you know, information coming from these you know, young protocols that are getting developed there at ETH Denver. What's important is to realize you're about the one percentile. You're still about the one percentile. Sure. Because sure. The knowledge base of this space is still very low. So I'll be meeting with platforms. I'm meeting with two of the large banks, family office, wealth managers here, and meeting with financial wealth managers in Singapore, including family offices. Their knowledge base can go from as little as I know about Bitcoin, I've heard about it, to I know about Bitcoin, I know about what a blockchain is, and I know about Ethereum, and it's all about being on the ETFs. So we are going to see that build out progressively, so that ultimately we can be having amazing conversations about what layer four protocols, in other words, applications that are going to be the replacements of the very big layer two, sorry, the very big web two centralized offerings now are getting developed. For all of that to be developed, you have to develop these extraordinary infrastructures that sit underneath it. And it's exciting space to be in, continues to be. And the need to share this and the need to educate is still as profoundly important as it was 4 years ago. What is there now? There's just a lot more to educate and a lot more to learn, I've got to say, along the way. So now next week, I think you're in another continent again.
I am. I'm actually heading back to India, not only for some personal family business, but also I have to meet a few founders and innovators while I'm there, especially in Bangalore, my hometown, and just be able to. I'm also, as I'm building a few things, Derek, I'm trying to scout for talent and, you know, ability for me to be able to temporarily offload some of the work that I'm trying to achieve for the projects that I'm involved in. So I think it's going to be interesting. It's going to be a mix of family time and it's going to be a mix of work, which is always the case, no matter where we travel. That includes your travels. Mm-hmm. There's always a mix of, you know, you have a part of your sort of extended family in Singapore, as I'm sure you're doing the same thing as well.
I
so do. Looking forward to that travel. And then I do plan to go to Nepal this time, which is an adjacent country to Bhutan, for a weekend of hike, just to be able to get some of that fresh air. And the Himalayan, the view of the Himalayan ranges, which is always refreshing. So I'll share some other perspective. I just hope that I don't get that. It'll be interesting if I get pulled for another crypto conference, a crypto conversation in Nepal. But we'll see. I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
That's a problem when you're a crypto rock star like you, Nitin. There's just no there's nowhere to hide. Wonderful. All right. So Nepal should be extraordinary. I've been to Nepal, hiked there, and I enjoyed staying in the Hotel Nirvana. I still remember having my photograph taken out the front saying, at last, my entire journey has arrived at Nirvana and I'm here. It's an extraordinary place. So fantastic conversation, Nitin, as normal. If we can take the world from the philosophy of Bhutan all the way to interoperability between layer two protocols, I think we've covered a fair amount.
And I think we have.
Look forward to seeing you next week out of India, and I'll be back in Australia. And of course, for those listening who are enjoying this, please subscribe and share it with friends. And we hope to see you at one of the conferences along the way. Bye for now.
Sounds good. Bye, Derek. Take care. Safe travels.
We hope you enjoyed our weekly conversation. If you have any questions, comments, or suggested topics, please contact Nitin Gaur or myself on the emails displayed here or via our LinkedIn profiles. Feel free to subscribe and share with like-minded friends. Stay well, inquisitive, and engaged. See you next week.